God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Nahum chapter 3, where we are ready to resume with verse 6. All right, as no one knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of a man who is in him, even so no one knows the thoughts of God except the spirit of God. And the spirit of God has chosen to communicate these thoughts through objective revelation. We find in the scripture, and these thoughts are comprised of various words, various technical comments, various technical terms that are used to describe the totality of God's plan. So if one is going to learn that plan, then one obviously has to recognize that we combine spiritual thoughts with spiritual words in order to communicate spiritual concepts. The key to all of this, of course, as we know, is that the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God. The unbeliever cannot understand God because he has missed the very first thing he has to do to orient to God, and that is to apply faith towards his plan. So, since the believer out of fellowship can likewise be hamstrung by the sin nature, it is imperative as we approach the Word of God this morning that you make sure you are in fellowship. This is easily accomplished. This is all based on the work of Christ on the cross, who died and paid for every sin that you ever have committed or ever will commit. And ultimately, all you have to do is cite these sins to God when you commit them, and God immediately does the same thing every time, cleanses you and forgives you, and puts you right back into fellowship. So the only thing that will hamstring this process is unforgiveness. If you fail to forgive other believers, you do not want to forgive. God has said he will not forgive you. So that's the time. This is the time to do the rebound technique if necessary. If you're already in fellowship, then it's a moot point. But if you're not, then now is the time to do so. And, of course, anything else you might need to do to clear the decks mentally so you can focus your attention and concentrate and profit from the teaching. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the system that you have established. We recognize that the agency that you have provided, the only authorized agency for the dissemination of the truth in this dispensation, is the local church, and that local churches that are not disseminating the truth and are not being pillars and supports of the truth are an affront to you. We also recognize you provide great grace so that we can do the things that are incumbent upon us, and pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to provide us or guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are here moving on with the latter portion here of the prostitute metaphor that is applied to Nineveh, beginning in verse 4. Which is a continuation, I believe, of verse 1, with verses 2 and 3 forming a bit of a parenthesis as he turns back to the battle itself. But the harlot, the charming one, the prostitute, the mistress of sorceries, has been busy out there in the world. And while people do not see things the way God necessarily sees them, when nations engage in international manipulation, when they engage in extracting tribute and profit from other nations in order to fill their own coffers, God sees that as an act of international prostitution. And God sees this also, this is often accomplished, of course, by means of international sorcery. That is, the making of treaties, the making of pledges that people do not intend to fulfill, to carry out. As we know, anybody who's done any serious study of U.S.-Soviet relations knows that the Soviets have never honored one treaty that they've signed. So these agreements are not worth the paper that they're written on. And the reality is, of course, they use various means, various nice speech to design to deceive and to bring them, we might say, under their spell. And Nineveh has been guilty of this, not only, of course, against Judah and against the northern kingdom Israel, but against other nations as well. And in verse 5, again, Nahum authenticates his prophetic gift here as he validates that I am speaking to you a word, a declaration of the Lord of the armies. This is not my opinion. The I am against you, while it is technically correct, I mean, it's, but it's not communicating, I don't think, what is there actually in the Hebrew. So he's authenticating his revelation here, his prophecy, his vision, as being that of the Lord of the armies. And the warrior king has now had enough, and he is going to go on the war path. And when he does, he will not turn back. There are passages in the Old Testament which indicate that when God unsheaths his sword, using that metaphor, that he will not put it back in the sheath until it is sated with blood. And we know this is just a small taste of what happens to Nineveh. And the destruction that happened to Nineveh was thorough and complete. This is just a foretaste of what's going to happen to the nations during Daniel's 70th week. And the judgments that will occur because of man's own stupidity, things men do to themselves, and things that will occur by the direct action of God. And these things will work together to reduce the world to a place where mortal man will be scarcer than pure gold. And when Jesus Christ returns again, he could immediately just end all this, grab all unbelievers, toss them into the lake of fire. He does not choose to. He physically touches down and begins a slaughter, the likes of which, again, this world has never seen. And apparently performs it all by himself. So we have those prophecies, you know, why are your garments stained red? Because I trod the winepress of God's wrath alone. And so we try to keep a balance. We have to. People don't like to focus on the judgments of God because they are vicious. They are cruel. But there's no way to soften these things down. If God is going to put people into the lake of fire and torture them endlessly throughout eternity, then this is nothing, essentially, compared to that, if you think about the concept of eternal torment. So here he continues the prostitute metaphor. I am going to lift up the hem of your skirts and put them over your face. So you will be blind, but your genitals will be exposed, and I will show to the nations your genitalia, and to the kingdoms your disgrace. Nakedness, again, as we saw, was a part of God's perfect creation between man and woman, but that all ended at the fall. The instincts of Adam and Eve were sound. They were correct in the fact that they needed clothing. But the clothing was not going to be the works of their hands. Again, great spiritual lessons found in the book of Genesis, beginning with initial creation in verse 1:1, and then with the restoration of planet Earth over a period of six literal 24-hour days. And this can all be proven, documented, that there is a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. But the lessons here are, the lesson with the animal skins, of course, points to the substitutionary sacrifice, points to the atonement that would come, a greater atonement that would come through Jesus Christ. So he continues on here now with his tirade against the prostitute. Again, the only difference in these words is the prostitute does it for money, the whore does it for free. That's the only difference. And the word has to be determined, the harlotry, the harlot, has to be determined in context what you're dealing with. Here, it is a prostitute. I will throw filth on you and make you vile and set you up as a spectacle. And I will throw, as they actually haven't translated here, the wow consecutive with the hifiel perfect, first person singular, shalak. And again, all throughout this, we know that, S-H-A-L-A-K, we know that the Nineveh was destroyed by a coalition of forces, the Babylonians, the Scythians, and the Medes. But throughout this section here, this is all first person. This is all personal with God. God is going to make sure that this happens. The word means, the shalak means to cast or hurl, but in the hifiel, it's only used in the hifiel and the hafal, so therefore it's kind of like a Greek deponent verb. It's not causative in this stem, where normally the hifiel would be causative. It's not I will cause to throw, it's I will throw. It's active in meaning, although causative in form. I will cast over you or upon you. Preposition ale here, used in a spatial sense, on top of you. I will pile you up against you. I will cast against you, and then the masculine plural noun, shikuts. S-H-I-Q-Q-U-T-S. Shikuts, again, they've translated it filth like it's a singular, but it is a plural. I will translate garbages, filths, refuses, that sort of thing. That which is detestable, that which is abominable, that which is filthy. I will cast these upon you, and I will make you vile. Again, a wow consecutive here with the PL perfect. First person singular. Again, God himself is seen as the agent in this of Nabal. N-A-B-H-A-L. Nabal is only used five times. In the Cal, it means to act foolishly. And in the PL, that means the PL here, the intensive, has the idea of the results of people acting foolishly, how people look at them, to treat someone with scorn, disgust, or contempt. So I will make you vile. I will here treat you. I will make you contemptible is the idea. People will see you and they will just sneer when they see you. And as we're going to see, we don't get it until the end of the book, but if you look at verse 19, there is no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable, and all who hear about you will clap their hands over you. What's Nineveh's destruction going to be met with? A great round of applause in the world. And this is the nature of, if you're oriented to God and his judgments, you see things from a different perspective than, say, the unbeliever out there who's not oriented to God and does not like the idea of judgment. And even as negative believers out there, they don't like to discuss these passages. They don't like to deal with them. As a matter of fact, I was reading one article, and this person made the observation that Nahum is probably the least liked book in the Old Testament, because it is just unrelentingly filled with judgment. There is no positive note in it at all to Nineveh, nor should there be. So I will throw filth on you, and I will make you contemptible. I will make you vile. I will set you up as a spectacle. The Cal perfect of the word here, although these are all perfects, they are prophetic perfects, and this basically assures us that the action in question will be accomplished. That's why he uses the perfect here, although they've translated them here as imperfects, although they are not. I'll take that back. They are translated as imperfects. I take that back. I've got wow consecutives here, so that's why they are translated as imperfects. Wow consecutive with the Cal perfect of seem, S-I-Y-M. That word just means to set, place, or put something. I will set you up like or as, inseparable preposition kaf, which introduces here a comparison, as, and then you got the word ra'i. R-A apostrophe I-Y. Literally, that which is seen, it comes from the verb ra'ah, to see. So that which one does see, the object of sight is the idea here. And it will come about that all who see will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. And it will come about as the wow consecutive. This will form is used so often in the Hebrew Old Testament, and often in the New American Standard, other translations, they'll translate it came to pass. You've got the wow consecutive plus the verb hayah, to become, and it will come about, or it will become, that all, masculine plural noun, or pardon me, masculine singular noun, construct of kol, all, each, or every, all of the ones seeing you. You've got the Cal active participle here functioning as a substantive, ra'ah, that is the verb from which that previous noun, ra'i, was derived. The one seeing you, and then the second masculine singular suffix. Now, the interesting thing here is the suffix is masculine. And so he's addressing a broader audience than just Nineveh. He's very consistent in this book of addressing Nineveh as a feminine. And we will see he does shift directly and address the king of Assyria later on. Directly, but most of the time it's directed towards the city, and so you have feminine suffixes typically. So it will come about that all of those seeing you, literally, seeing you, will shrink from you. You got the Cal imperfect, third masculine singular of Nadad. N-A-D-H-A-D-H. This word indicates motion, often in a particular direction. And so it often means to move away from something, and so they've translated it by the words shrink or shrink away. The idea is to travel away. They're going to see the place, and they're not going to want to stick around. The devastation is going to cause them to want to get out of there. Because the reality is, of course, that anybody who looks at it has to ask the question, how and why did this happen? How did this come to be? And the answer is, of God, of course, the God of heaven, the warrior God, has destroyed the place. And so when people see that and become aware of it, it's not going to be comfortable for them to stand there and observe the ruins that are left. So they will shrink away from you and say, while consecutive with the cal perfect of Amer, the simple verb to say, Nineveh is devastated. A pu'al perfect of the verb shadad. S-H-A-D-H-A-D-H. And as you can tell, hopefully you can see there, this is one of the things that Nahum does that we'll never come across in the English, is the use of these words that sound alike, or that in many cases are almost spelled alike. The subtleties in the Hebrew here, the rhyming scheme, the poetic type way he writes, is not lost on the technical interpreters. Some of them, not all of them, are technical interpreters. I recognize that. But the fact is, they recognize this, and they will comment on it repeatedly. So the pu'al here is the intensive passive stem. The idea is completely devastated. It's completely done in. And in fact, as we know, the devastation was so complete that Nineveh never has been essentially populated. There were small periods of time where, during intertestamental period, where people tried to reestablish the place, but it never did work. So Nineveh is devastated. And then you got the proper name there, Nineveh. Who will grieve for her? The interrogative pronoun who is me, M-I-Y. And then the cal imperfect third masculine singular here of nude, N-U-D-H. The verb literally means to sway back and forth or to move. It's used of aimless wandering. It's also used for shaking the head back and forth to indicate sympathy or compassion. And that's the way it's used here. They've translated it as grieve. Who will have any sympathy for Nineveh? The answer is nobody. These rhetorical questions point to the fact that nobody cared about Assyria. Assyria had alienated everybody. And the capital city served as sort of the figurehead of all this. So who will have sympathy for her? Nobody. Nobody's going to. God didn't, and nobody else will. To her or for her is the inseparable preposition lamed plus the second feminine, third feminine singular suffix. Towards her, towards Nineveh. Where will I seek comforters for you? Literally, from where, the preposition men, and then it's coupled with the adverb ayin. A-Y-I-N. Actually, the adverb means where by itself. So from where is fine, or where is fine by itself. The two words together sort of mean that. Will I seek? PL imperfect, bakash. And this verb is used for seeking, B-A-Q-A-S-H. For seeking something that exists or is thought to exist. So it's looking for something that one expects to find. And this, in this context, it indicates God's not going to find him. From where will I seek comforters for you? The PL participle of nakam, N-A-C-H-A-M, here again functions as a substantive. The verb means to breathe deeply. And it's used of displaying the emotions of sorrow, compassion, or comfort. And so here, because it's a participle, masculine, plural, they've translated it as comforters. And that's fine. And again, for you is the inseparable preposition lamed plus the second feminine singular suffix. And as one might imagine, of course, if this prostitute becomes so despised, as she does, And it's truly, God makes her this gross spectacle that people would want to shy away from. Nobody's going to want to stand around and feel sorry for her. That's a fact. All right, point one here. As if stripping the prostitute bare and exposing her to international shame were not enough. God continues the punishment of the hooker in verse 6. Two, this is all quite personal with God, who continues to ascribe these actions to himself, even though they will be carried out by the Mede, Babylonian, and Scythian coalition. We know, again, historically how Nineveh fell, and it was not a long siege. Indications are that it lasted less than 3 months. And that's for a fortified city of that size and of that stature, that's unreal. Some sieges would last in the terms of years, not months. And certainly not less than 3 months. But history has it that this did not take long at all. And of course, as we know, history also tells us, the waters upon which Nineveh was situated there, as we will find out, that's coming up in the following verses about Noamon or Thebes of Egypt, that the waters there actually worked against Nineveh. That was the problem. That is part of what took their wall down. And once the wall's down, well, you're done pretty much. There's nowhere to go. In verse 6, God continues his assault on Nineveh by promising to cast filth on her. For the Hebrew noun shekuts, filth is derived from a verb that means to consider something to be abhorrent or detestable. It is also used in a causative sense and means to make something abominable or detestable, as per Leviticus 11. Leviticus 11:11-13 is the word here translated abhorrent. And they shall be abhorrent to you, that you may not eat their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Whatever in the water does not have fins and scales is abhorrent to you. See, Jews don't like catfish. Well, nobody in their right mind likes catfish. No, they're fine. The point here is, and one of the things you got to understand when you're dealing with the Old Testament, particularly in terms of the Mosaic Covenant, is you have to understand that the Mosaic Covenant contained a ceremonial code. It contained a legal code for civil code for how to live life. And the entire code itself, it contained a religious code. And so you have to keep these separate. And you have to understand that as a believer in the church age, we're still obligated to the moral aspects of the Mosaic Law. We do not. Some groups want to just throw out the Mosaic Law. They want to throw out Israel completely, in fact. Many of these are failed dispensationalists. But they want to toss Israel out, covenant theologians. They replace, when they read the Old Testament and they come across Israel, they say, oh, that applies to the church now. No, it doesn't. It absolutely does not. And these people are so wrong, it's not even funny. But we don't throw out the moral aspects of the Mosaic Code. The ceremonial aspects, we're no longer under that. That's very clearly taught, say, in the book of Galatians and other places. It became an issue, of course, in the early church in the book of Acts. And that's thus prompted the first, what we call the first Jerusalem conference. As Paul and his sect, as it was looked at, came against the Judaizers. And the Judaizers were people that wanted to enforce the Mosaic Law in the church age, all of it. And so they demanded that if you were going to be a believer in Jesus Christ, you had to get circumcised. And you had to keep all the Mosaic Law. And, of course, this was all changed. Peter got an object lesson in this on the roof there at the house of Cornelius while he was waiting there for his, when he had this vision when he was waiting to eat. I believe that's Acts chapter 10 or 11 in there. And he got an object lesson on the fact that we're not under the ceremonial code of the Mosaic Law. So while it was a sin under Jewish law for a Jew to eat catfish or lobster, it's not a sin for us to. And it's not a sin to wear garments of two different kinds, two different weaves, two different fabrics. You can plant two different kinds of seed in your field now, if you're a believer. Now, if you live under the Judaistic customs, well, then you're just living under a failed deal that didn't ever accomplish anything. And Paul points that out. So here you got that which is abhorrent, that which is detestable here, these animals. These, moreover, shall you detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle, the vulture, and the buzzard. I never wanted to eat any of them anyway. So no big deal. Here it also is used, of course, now to make something abominable or detestable. And that's seen in 11:43. Do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with them, so that you will become unclean. And of course, the ceremonial code of the Mosaic Law is designed simply to point out, essentially one of the things it points out, is that there's a sacrifice provided for every violation of the code. There's an appropriate sacrifice that gets the believer, we might say, back into fellowship. And so one of the things that the ceremonial code does for us is it shows us the simplicity of rebound. And it also points to the finished work of Christ on the cross. Because we're not repeating these same offerings over and over and over again. Because they don't need to be repeated over and over and over again. There was one offering made for all time. That's set forth very clearly in the book of Hebrews. So the Hebrew noun again here means to consider something to be abhorrent. And in a causative sense it means to make something abhorrent. Five, the term is actually found in the plural, which denotes the intense, repeated action of throwing every kind of filth on the prostitute. Six, this is a very strong word, which is normally used in contexts that deal with abominations that were regular features, that should be features, of pagan idol worship. Deuteronomy 29:17. So again, I don't throw the term abomination around lightly. It's applied to some things, but it's not applied to everything. Everything, again, is not an abomination. You may not like it, but that doesn't make it an abomination just because you don't like it. There are a lot of things I don't like. Deuteronomy 29:17, moreover, you have seen their abominations and their idols of wood, stone, silver, and gold, which they had with them. See, this gets back again to why are these idols so abominable? Because in the Mosaic Code, one of the first things God spelled out is you do not make any image of me at all, ever. And any time anybody made a, quote, image of any kind of a god, it's offensive to God, very highly offensive to God. Because you cannot represent the divine essence with images. How are you going to portray omnipresence? What kind of image are you going to have for that? It's going to have to be real big. That's going to have to be huge, have to fill all space. How are you going to pray omniscience? God is just a big brain. You know, that's your idol, it's a brain on a stick. That represents omniscience. Well, you can see where that would be offensive to God. That's my idol, that's my brain on a stick. So, you know, any of these other things. How are you going to portray immutability? I carry around a rock. God, this is my idol. God is a rock. Well, God is a rock. But you can't just represent God as a rock because a rock is unthinking, unfeeling, all those other things. It is, in fact, you know, it's at that level, we might say, immutable. So how are you going to portray God as truth? You're going to carry around a set of scales like, you know, Lady Justice does? All that? So you couldn't make, effectively, an image that represented the 10 attributes of the divine essence. And so when these people made these images, of course, they were actually fashioning images to demons. Little did they know. These gods of the Gentiles are just simply demons behind the scenes manipulating these people. 1 Kings 11:5 also. So God uses this very strong word to say, essentially, every kind of crap I can find, I'm going to throw on you. And that's not an exaggeration of what the idea is. Every offensive thing. 1 Kings 11:5. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom. And God's really offended by goddesses because God's always portrayed as male. We know that God is a spirit, that he's neither, quote, male nor female. But God always references himself as a male. The normal pronouns, he, him, his, are all used of God. And so to represent God as a female, that's highly offensive to God. and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And the Ammonites were into child sacrifice and a number of other things, passing their children through fire. These people, and if you get into the real background and the history of all of these pagan cults and their rituals and all of that, they were also heavily loaded with ritual prostitution. The Vestal Virgins are just simply temple prostitutes. That's all they are. And now that makes, I know, for a pretty good religion for some people. What do you want to do? Well, let's go worship God, have sex, and go home. And that was essentially, in a nutshell, what these pagan rituals and all were all about in many cases. Also, Ezekiel 5:11. So, while that may be popular to your phallic reversionist, it's not with God, and it's not with adjusted believers. They would have none of that. And so, as you get doctrinal, you know, as over the years as you grow, you learn to grow in grace, but you learn to also grow in righteous indignation and a certain level of intolerance towards that which is just clearly bad. It's not tolerant to say that something bad is okay. It's stupid to say that something bad is okay. So this stuff is horrible. And God makes no secret out of it. Ezekiel 5:11, so as I live, declares the Lord. Surely because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable idols and with all your abominations. Therefore I will also withdraw, and my eye will have no pity, and I will not spare. One third of you will die by the plague or be consumed by famine among you. One third will fall by the sword around you, and one third I will scatter to every wind. And I will unsheath a sword behind them. And for whatever reason, it appears, you know, this third appears to be the number of the remnant of positive in Israel, because it's used later on in prophetic contexts. So and that's a pretty high level. I mean, if you look at the positive volition among the Gentiles, it doesn't approach a third, I don't think, at all. So here again, it's a very strong word. 7, once God cast the filth, garbage, dung, refuse, and other vile things upon the prostitute, which is designed to convey maximum divine disrespect. The resultant state is described by the following verb, and I will make you vile. 2 Kings 10:27. They broke down the sanctuary, the sacred pillar of Baal, and broke down. Baal was the son in the mother-son cult. And this religion, of course, goes back to ancient Babylon. It comes out of the Tower of Babel, and it infiltrated essentially all the nations. All of them have these mother-son cults in them. The great whore, the Catholic Church, is involved in the mother-son cult big time. And that is highly offensive to God. And doing it in the name of God is even worse. Trying to convince people that you're something you're not. If a person believes Catholic doctrine, I can tell you they're not believers. If they believe Catholic doctrine and embrace it, they are working their way to heaven, or so they think. Because it is an entirely works-oriented religion, but it is heavily involved in the mother-son cult. That's why you see these little statues of the Virgin Mary. They've exalted Mary to the title Queen of Heaven. And this you can easily find out by any research. Anybody can find this out. You just go and look up the Pope and the edicts that he's passed, his little utterances. And Mary was exalted as the Queen of Heaven. And their doctrine is so gross and so offensive to a positive believer that it's almost unspeakable what they are. But again, Revelation 17 sets it up pretty much. Although they're dressed in scarlet and gold and all sorts of fancy things, and the Pope looks really good in his Pope mobile. Well, guess what? God's not impressed. And 2 Kings here, 27, they broke down the sacred pillar of Baal and broke down the house of Baal, and they made it a latrine to this very day. Now that's maximum disrespect. I'm going to turn your house into a dung heap, a latrine. Also Daniel 2:5. And in Daniel 2:5, this is a cognate. Here, the king replied to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, drawn and quartered, and your houses will be made into a rubbish heap." Same word, dung heap, a bathroom. "We're going to turn your house into a latrine." Again, that is the maximum divine disrespect. 8, the verb navel means first to act in a senseless or foolish fashion. It is used 4 times in the PL and expresses disgust or contempt. And 9, just as detestable practices produce loathing in a normal person, so Nineveh's detestable actions of prostitution and sorcery will cause God to treat the city as the loathsome, detestable, and abominable place it is. So while God is very patient, as we know, he didn't reduce Nineveh. I mean, they had, really, following the preaching of Jonah, circa 760 B.C., this prophecy is probably uttered closer to 660. So they had 100 years, and they didn't use it very well. They unfortunately wasted a lot of their time and descended into greater evil than what they were into at Jonah's day. And this, of course, should cause the normal person to cringe. There's a certain level at which you hear about these types of things, and it's not designed to produce a good feeling in you. 10 rather here, Halot, the Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament, suggests that the verb also denotes the idea of treating something as if it were not valid, to declare something to be void or worthless. 11, condemned for her ways and seen as a despicable prostitute, God heaps refuse on her. And the once haughty city has now been turned into something worthless and disgusting. And 12, a second result is that after God has pelted Nineveh with filth, she will become a spectacle of shame for all to see, a monument of disgrace. 13, this is the sense of the final part of verse 6, which literally states in the Hebrew, "I will set you like a site." Or set you up as a site is sort of the idea. Something to be looked at and just, you know, just to gross people out. A horrible spectacle to remind, and people will remember, of course, what Assyria was before, what Nineveh was. Well, 14, it is amply attested in Assyrian writings that kings often paraded their captives publicly so that they could be seen and ridiculed. A. Sargon records the fact that he exposed Mutalu, the son of a rebel, to public gaze. That's in his Annals 1.210. B. Ashurbanipal states that he put one Deite into a kennel with jackals and dogs. He goes on to say that he tied him up and made him guard the gate in Nineveh. Maximum exposure, maximum public humiliation. That's the goal. C. He further records that he cut off the lips and took the Elamites to Assyria as a spectacle for the people of my land. So these, again, were not, these parts probably are not exaggerated, unfortunately. They're all probably too true. But God's aware of this type of activity in which they engage. And again, you have to kind of bridge the cultural gap between us, you know, living some 2000 A.D., back to the time and the world in which this all was happening. And God sees each and every act of these kings. And he sees the arrogance behind it. And he sees the inhumanity that characterized these people. They were anything but humane. They would treat animals better than they would treat people sometimes. And that's just gross. That's for the PETA people out there. Treating animals better than treating people. No, I'd rather experiment on rats and let them save lives. Thank you very much. And I don't have anything against fur, especially not this morning. Not that I would wear it. Well, 15, just as Nineveh had done to others in the past, so now God will do to her. She will become a spectacle to be observed and ridiculed by other nations. 16, the image here is that of a prostitute that has become old and disgusting and is now treated with abhorrence and contempt. 17, those who had once vied for her attention and paid for her sexual favors will come to treat her with disdain and will pretend that they never knew her. And again, prostitution is about, you know, for all their talk, it's about anything but love. It's about power, control, and contempt, really, is what it's about. And the John is under the control of the prostitute, like it or not. And the prostitute, unfortunately, reciprocates, comes under the control of the John. Well, again, people, when these prostitutes get old and ugly and gross, nobody wants anything to do with them. Well, nobody in their right mind wants anything to do with them when they're not. But again, this is not anything new in human history. This has been going on for years, from the earliest times, of course. 18, Nahum now moves to the future of Nineveh after the capital is devastated, covered in filth, and a solemn warning to those that see what is left. 19, Nahum moves to the head to the time when travelers would be moving through Assyria and come upon the ruins of the once, that should be once, prominent, wealthy, and magnificent city. And again, Assyria was quite a place. Again, you're talking walls over 50 feet thick, even 100 feet thick around the gates. You're talking about a great library, a great culture. You're talking about tremendous temples and palaces. There were at least two palaces in there. And so you have all of this reduced just to a dung heap, essentially. That, you know, the best use for it at that point is a latrine. So 20, the verb he uses to describe the observer's response is nadad, flee, which basically connotes motion away from something. And 21, in this case, the idea is that those that see the remains of Nineveh will find the sight so repulsive that they will quickly turn away in disgust. Psalm 31:11. Here David talked about, and this was a part, no doubt, I don't have any problem believing this comes right out of the Operation Bathsheba, some of the outfall or the fallout that came away that David had to live with, and in some cases for the rest of his life, and in some cases not. But as he talks about, his life is spent with sorrow, in verse 10, and my years with sighing, my strength has failed because of my iniquity, and my body has wasted away. David, whatever disease he had. And this went on for close to a year after he killed Uriah and took his wife. And David did not rebound. And God jammed him big time. As a matter of fact, he was to the point of death. He went downhill and kept going downhill. And because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach. And the people saw David at this weak time, his adversaries, his enemies, they came out of the woodwork after him. This was the time they saw he was weak, they saw he was down, this is the time to go after David. Anybody that had any grudge, any problem with David, once they see he's got his problems, now they're going after him. I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I am forgotten as a dead man, out of mind. I am like a broken vessel, for I have heard the slander of many. And of course, this is the time they began their verbal public campaign against David. Anybody that had a problem with David, let's win him over now, because David's down and we can take him. Terror is on every side. While they took counsel together against me, they schemed to take away my life. And yet, out of all of this pain and anguish and even self-induced misery that he brought upon himself, David survives all this. And returns to spiritual greatness, although living the rest of his life under a certain amount of divine discipline. And so we see both the goodness and severity of God. Well, 22, all those that pass by move quickly away from the sight. They will comment to themselves about the unbelievable reality of what has happened to the mighty city. And 23, it is not just that the city has suffered a setback. The unthinkable has occurred. The city has not merely been defeated or taken in battle. The city is laid waste. And the Assyrians, for instance, like when they captured Babylon, they didn't wreck the city. They set up a puppet government there and left Babylon intact. And so they didn't ruin the city. And so typically, when you had a rich and mighty and powerful city like this, you would not destroy it. You would not raise it to the ground. You would go in and plunder what you wanted, but you would establish some leadership there, and the city would still be a functioning part of the empire. Not so for Nineveh. Complete destruction. And again, I cannot help but see the parallels between this and the United States. It's not just that we're going to suffer a military defeat. It's going to be completely laid waste. It's going to be turned into a nuclear desert because of the sins against the God of heaven. Again, the reality is, there was a deal on the news, and I don't know if any of them saw it, but there was this weird series of lights that they saw over Norway and Finland. And it looked like, and they had a picture of it, and it just looked like a spiral going in on itself. And as it turned out, it was another failed Soviet missile attempt. They were launched a missile. Apparently, this family of missiles has been known for failing. And so it failed, and that was as it traveled downward in its spiral, that was the path that it left. So the Soviets, by the way, if people are not up on it, are still wildly engaged in nuclear buildup. Just biding their time, waiting for the right moment to take the West. And they think what Khrushchev thought and said and what he meant, and we will bury you. And that has not changed. Oh, they cover it now with words like detente and glasnost and perestroika. But guess what? Just words. Just. Ooh. Now you're under the Soviet spell. We'll be nice to you. Yes, until the time changes, and then you won't. And that's a part of the sorcery, using these spells, these incantations, these words that get people to think a certain way, that bring them to that. All right, well, point 24 here. The final two rhetorical questions are attributed by some to those that pass by and see Nineveh. However, it seems more likely that the questions are asked by Nahum, or even more directly that they're asked by God. Who will grieve for her? Nahum is pointing out here that nobody's going to. But again, whether you attribute him to God or Nahum, I do not attribute him to those passing by. I think their statement is very simply, Nineveh is devastated. That's their view on it when they see it all. I think these questions are to be attributed to the author. 25, the first question asked, who will grieve for her? Suggesting that no one will be interested in showing pity on the fallen city. 26, the verb nude basically connotes movement back in a back and forth fashion. In context where the idea of grieving or lamenting is in view, it denotes the action of nodding one's head back and forth in a display of pity or empathy. And sometimes, that's not unusual. You've seen that happen before. People will do that, nod their head in a certain way to express, hey, I feel sorry for you. I see what's going on here. He says nobody's going to do that. Nobody's going to walk up and go, oh, I'm too bad. They're going to just want to get out of there. And they're not going to stick around. They're not even going to want to. 27, the second rhetorical question, like the first, implies that there is not a place where the prophet can seek to find someone to comfort Nineveh. Where are you going to look? And all this just points to the fact that the Ninevites, the Assyrians, had so alienated everyone. People throughout the world hated these people. These people were gross even to the idol-worshipping pagans in Babylon. These people were gross. And all the other nations that were engaged in similar activities, the Assyrians were the top of the list for who to hate the most. Who gets the number one most hated nation in history? Probably Assyria, the greatest hated empire. We'll probably be a close second, however, who knows. So the second rhetorical question, again, is like the first. There's not a place to find somebody to comfort Nineveh. 28, try as he might, there is not anyone among any of the nations that have the slightest concern for the horrible fate that befell the city. And 29, in that regard, the rapacious and cruel way in which the prostitute had conducted herself over the course of her history has completely alienated anyone that might have any possible reason to mourn for Nineveh. They didn't even appear to care about the grandeur records that were destroyed and all of that. None of this made any difference. When they leveled the city, again, they razed it to the ground. Now we get into a bit of an excursus here as he brings up a history lesson to point out to the Ninevites that their plight and that their future is not going to be any better than that which was the future of Thebes or the current state of Thebes. And this would have been, again, I think the closer this is written to the fall of Thebes, the more benefit, the more sense it makes that this idea would be used, that this object would be brought up. Because this example of Thebes here would be fresh on their minds. And Thebes fell, by the way, as we'll point out as we get through this, Thebes was destroyed by Assyria. And so this was something that was in their culture, in their mindset. Word of this was certainly would have gotten back by this time, as we'll see. So verse 8 here, are you better than Noamon? Which was situated on the banks of the Nile, with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, and whose wall consisted of the sea. Are you better begins the, well, the sentence begins with the interrogative particle, hey, or ha, actually, which is, this is how they introduce a question. They just prefix the interrogative particle to the first word. And then you got the hifil imperfect of yatav. Y-A-T-A-B-H. The verb means to be good. And when followed by the preposition men, as we saw in the book of Ecclesiastes, to be good from something means are you better than in our idiom. That's the way we would express it. As Solomon pointed out there in Ecclesiastes, some things are better than others. A live dog's better than a dead lion. Some things are better than others. Now, this is what discernment brings us to, the understanding of which things are good, which things are better, and which things are best. Some people, most people out there, are just willing to settle for good enough. And that's where most people are, both religiously and even personally in their lives. They just, it's good enough. As long as it's done. And so we recognize, as you get discernment, you recognize certain things, certain approaches are better than other approaches. Certain things work better than other things do. So are you good from, and that's what we have here, you have the preposition men, then no am on. And that's exactly, it's transliterated actually right over. That's exactly the way it looks. N-O-A-M-O-N. Again, Noamon refers to Thebes. You can see the map there. Thebes is somewhat in the highlands of Egypt. This was in Upper Egypt. And again, we tend to use, as you're looking, you know, the map is situated north-south there. We tend to use north-south as up and down. But they, in the ancient world, they tended to use elevation as up and down. You went up to Jerusalem, which was located on a hill. You went down to Gaza because it was situated low, it was a lowland strip there by the sea. So here, are you better than Noamon? And Thebes was the capital of Upper Egypt, and Memphis tended to be the capital of Lower Egypt. And at sometimes during Egyptian history, they had a unified capital, and most often when there was a unified capital, it was at Memphis. But they did have two capitals. And this is where Egyptology, and this is where, see, conventional chronology, the way that people base all this, is based on Egyptology largely. And it's based on Egyptian chronology. And failure to understand that certain dynasties could be ruling concurrently in Egypt from two different places has led people to stretch out the Egyptian chronology too far. And they have not got things dated properly. Again, they completely have the Exodus in the wrong place. They've got the Exodus down, in many cases, around 1250 B.C. under Ramses. And so you'll see, you know, if you see the, you know, the old movie, The Ten Commandments, you know, it's Ramses was the king. No, it wasn't Ramses. And even the Disney remake of the little cartoon, Ramses was not the Pharaoh of the Exodus. So they've got that all wrong, and this is why biblical chronology differs widely in some cases, by a couple hundred years in many cases, from conventional chronology. But again, failure to understand these types of things has led these people into these errors. So are you better than Noamon, which is Thebes? The one dwelling, which was situated, is the way they've translated here. You got the definite article with the calactic participle of Yashah. Y-A-S-H-A-B-H. And that word means dwelling or residing on the Nile or on the river. You got the inseparable preposition bait here, plus the definite article, plus the masculine singular noun of Yaor. Y-E apostrophe O-R. The idea is a river or stream that has formed a definite channel. Now, this word is most often used of the Nile in the Old Testament. And it may be an Egyptian loanword. We don't really know the origin of it. Some have suggested that because the way the word is translated most often, but you'll see it when you find it, it's by the term Nile. So, and they supply rightly so here, which was situated on the banks of the Nile. Because you don't sit, or actually they've translated situated by the waters of the Nile. I added the phrase on the banks because it's situated on the ground, obviously, not on the water, right on it. So the Nile, waters surrounding, literally. Mayim is the word for waters, and then the adverb saviv. S-A-V-H-I-V-H. Saviv, I-Y-V-H. That means surrounding something, to be encompassing something, being on every side. Whose rampart was the sea, literally water surrounding to her, literally the inseparable preposition lamed plus the second feminine singular. Then you have the relative pronoun, a relative particle here, whose is asher, who, what, or which, whose barrier, kale, is the word. C-H-E-Y-L. That means a defensive barrier, a rampart, or a bulwark, whose bulwark was the sea. Now, this expression here is a little bit problematic because, as you can clearly see from the map, Thebes does not sit close to the Red Sea there, that arm of the Red Sea. And we'll deal with this more. We're going to have to go ahead and stop and take our 20-minute break. So let's go ahead and do that now, and we will resume here at 5 after.